John Busby with the Culture Buzz, and joining me in the studio right now is a wonderfully regular guest on the Culture Buzz. In fact, I use his poetry as buffers as often as I can between interviews. Dennis Malsby is with us again. It's been my honor to develop a friendship with him over the years. He's been very gracious in his time and kind of connecting with me and keeps me updated. And I'm just like a proud papa. I just kind of shake my head with a great big grin on my face and say, boy, you are doing good. And it's kind of an odd relationship that we have, but it's okay. Dennis says he's got a great website. Go to DennisMalsby.com, Dennis, MALSBY.com. And I love how it shows up. Where was that tagline there? I write for therapy, or?
Yes.
I stumblingly broached that subject, but talk about your background, just a quick, I stepped on the elevator and I need to tell this person my life history and why I do poetry, but it is a life that goes clear back to military. So give us that overview.
Yeah, well, I'm an Iowan, born in Iowa, raised and educated in Iowa, and then, of course, went into the military. At that time, they had the draft, but and then the draft board said, what are you going to be doing after you graduate from college? And I said, well, I've got $1.99. I can't go too far on that. And they said, well, you better go sign up and voluntarily get something, because the draft board is going to be right on you. And you won't be able to find a job because people know you're prime draft material and they're not going to want you to be there for a few months and then get drafted. So I did. I signed up, went in the military. I was there for about 4 years, 7 months. Started out as a private, entered as a first lieutenant. Spent a year in Vietnam, which is probably the wellspring from which the poetry that I write springs. And basically, I had a friend of mine that said, when we came back from Vietnam, we handled our demons, but with women, drugs, or creativity. And creativity is the most safest of the three, I assure you. So I went into, I tried a lot of creative aspects, art of various kinds, and none of that lasted too long. And then I went into writing, and of course, we have over 1 million words in English, more added every year, new ones. So I don't think I'm going to run out of those in my lifetime. I started out with poetry, and I wanted to master the imagery and the sensuality of poetry and then bring that into prose, first in the form of short stories, which in many ways are very similar to poetry, and then into novels. And so I've had poetry published, both self-published and individuals published in numerous journals. I've had a traditionally published book of poetry called Near Death, Near Life. And I've had a book of short stories published called Free Fire Zone. And announced first on your program, I signed a contract last week to have a second book of short stories called Winterset Tales, published by Neoleaf Press here in Des Moines.
So. Wow. I admire the fact that you recognized that you needed to develop a special relationship with an inner muse for yourself, and you chose creativity. As you said, it would be the least deadly option of the ones that were seemingly out there for anyone returning from Vietnam, and as it turns out, from any kind of traumatic experience, wartime experience situation. And it's something that you have used very much to help yourself process what you've experienced. But at the same time, you become such an exceptional advocate for writing as a great vehicle for anyone and everyone. Your goal does not have to be to become a multiple published poet or writer. It is something that just simply helps people process, isn't it?
Right. It doesn't make any difference if you have a traumatic event or events in your background. Doesn't have to be necessarily warfare, although you're sure to have them if you're in war or combat. that writing is really a good way to deal with it. And I would highly recommend it to anybody. You know, be creative. If writing doesn't suit you, then try some other creative aspect. But creativity is really a good way to deal with trauma.
Yeah. And I will say this to you folks out there saying, well, I don't know, I'm not creative. Well, give yourself the freedom to give it a try for the simple reason that it's like any kind of skill that you want to develop. You need to practice, work at it, and do give a commitment to it and just say, okay, I'm going to try this. Read, find poets you like if poetry is going to be your focus, and go from there. Here in a little bit, I'm going to relinquish the microphone for Dennis for an extended reading that is going to come from that new book that we just, I feel very honored. We're breaking the news here. I love that, Dennis.
You get a scoop.
How about that? It's a Culture Buzz scoop. So it's going to be some deliciously creative ice cream, I'll put it that way. If nothing else, it will be something that probably has a little bit of savory, a little bit of sweet, and a little bit of anything and everything in between. But DennisMalsby.com is the website. If you go to all the good independent bookstores like Beaverdale Books, they do a great job of carrying Dennis's collections up there. And go to his website. He will keep you well informed of where he may be appearing in the future, doing events and things like that. You can always get his books and poetry that way. I'm going to step aside now and turn the microphone over for several minutes here as Dennis Malsby gives an introduction to where this passage comes from and what it's about.
This is the new book of short stories that Neoleaf Press has agreed to publish, and takes place here in Iowa. Basically, there's 12 short stories, and they relate the supernatural adventures of Father Patrick Donahue, the Irish-born father, retired from many years of service as a Catholic priest in South America, and he comes to Winterset, Iowa for his retirement. It's not to be the life of books and long rural walks that he suspects. The community and the surrounding area are awash with supernatural creatures, some friendly, some not, but all must be dealt with in order to protect his new parish, state, county, and the wider world from chaos and destruction. So a series of 12 stories. I'll be reading a shortened version of the very first story, and it's called The Night of the Puka. Light glimmered in the rectory window past the hour when its occupants should be back in bed. Father Ignatius Patrick Donahue sat in an old wing-back chair. His body shivered as he turned the pages of an ancient book. Finding the reference, he reached into a jacket pocket for his meerschaum pipe and tobacco pouch. He sucked the flame of an age-scarred Zippo lighter into the brandy-flavored shag packed in the bowl. The tongue bite and honey smell of the smoke slowed his heartbeat. He replayed the mind-boggling tales that had come from the other side of the confessional earlier in the evening. The first of the stories he would have chalked up to hysteria. However, the two confessions meshed completely. The witnesses to the events, a teacher and a sheriff's deputy, were both sensible members of the community. I am too old for this, he thought. Happily retired, his service to the church had started over 60 years ago. Leaving a tiny backcountry Irish village at 18, he had progressed through the Catholic Church hierarchy. His employment slowed by aging, the bishop allowed him to select from a worldwide list of parishes with light-duty positions. His natal village now only abandoned heaps of decaying thatch and tumbled rock walls. He chose to replant his roots in St. Joseph Church in the town of Winterset, Iowa. His only priestly responsibility was to fill in when the local priest was sick or traveling. In that capacity, he was handling the confessional when one of the haunts of his youth reappeared, a creature of stories told around the night fires of his childhood. His mind reconstructed the events described in the confessions. Shannon crouched among 8-foot-tall rustling October corn. Her breath came in jagged gasps. The noise of her panting and the pain in her side blocked the sound of her pursuers. Running through dark fields clad only in bra and panties took its toll. Corn-leafed edges slashed exposed skin. Currently, this was a minor worry. She was more scared of dashing headlong into a corn spider web. The huge webs, invisible at night, stretched across furrows. A spider as big as a man's hand occupied the center. It would be terrifying to have one wrapped around your face, imprisoned over your eyes and mouth by its own sticky web. If she hadn't been working late correcting papers, the escaped convicts would have missed her. The pair grabbed her in the night dark Winterset Middle School parking lot, taking both her car and herself. Purse open to retrieve keys when captured, Shannon managed to drop her wallet. They holed up in her old farmhouse. They had not molested her the first day, their eyes and ears glued to TV news. Day two started with hungry looks. Their faces took on the grinning idiot look of men contemplating violence. That evening, under cover of making supper, she turned the iron to its highest setting and started boiling water. They attacked in the kitchen. She lost shoes, blouse, and skirt in the uneven struggle. Biting one on the ear allowed her to spring free. She grabbed the iron and thrust its red-hot sole plate against neck skin. A male screeched. Shannon ran. Fingers seized her thigh. She grabbed the pot handle, threw boiling water on the ankles of the second man. The screen door slammed back with the noise of a gunshot. She raced across the backyard and plunged into the cornrows. There were ways of keeping your bearing in cornfields. If you went straight down a row, you would eventually come to a gravel road or a fence line. However, the criminals forced her to go cross furrow, which meant she was wandering in circles. Darkness came. Scattered moving lights appeared in the field. Searchers called her name. She figured the authorities had finally found her wallet in the school lot. Yet every time she managed to arrive where the lights had been, they were gone. Shannon heard stalks rustling. The two convicts pushed through corn plants. "It's time now." A fish punched her in the chin. She lost her footing and flew backwards. Attracted by the voice, something large crashed through the field. A tall, four-legged creature, as black as India ink and monstrously huge, straddled her supine body. A curse came from one of the men. "Damn!" Her eyes swept up along hooves, fetlocks, cannons, and hocks. A horse. It smelled of primordial sulfur and iron. One of the men raised her daddy's old shotgun. The animal reared, struck out. The sound of steel striking steel echoed down the rows. The gun went off, spinning like a propeller. A burst of gelatinous fire, 5 feet long, blew out of the animal's nostrils and lit up the dark. A convict screamed. The man's hands slapped at the flames, devouring his face. Hoofs slashed the air. A thunk like metal hitting bone, and the attacker went down. The second convict ran. The stallion pursued. Dry leaves snapped. Another flaring flare of fire cut off a shriek. The blaze set jagged shadows dancing. A pounding, stomping, earthquake vibration followed. Car lights appeared. Shannon rose and ran. The end of the field neared. From beneath her came the crashing sound of the demon stallion. Had the headlights grew brighter, thighs burning, chest heaving, she stopped. Down the cornrow came the coal-black horse, its eyes pulsing with flame, as unstoppable as a locomotive. Hardly slowing, its head thrust between her legs, scooped the woman up and let her slide down its neck. Shannon knotted her fingers into its mane, as soft and strong as fine silk. Stretching legs propelled them at a speed that glued Shannon's body to its back. Feelings of terror began to be replaced by exhilaration. The creature's body felt hot. Its flesh warmed her like an electric blanket set on high. The wraith broke out of the field, shedding remnants of stalks and dross. Shannon could see the sheriff's deputy in the blaze of light coming from the patrol car's headlights and flashers. The man flopped as the stallion threatened to run through him. The demon increased speed. The cruiser's lights blinded Shannon. Just as she thought they would crash, the horse soared. She whooped and laughed. Everything lapsed into slow motion. The stars overhead stretched into long strings of light. The devil animal floated over the 18-foot-long Crown Vic. They touched down. Turning in its own length, the stallion shook itself sideways. Shannon tumbled off. The massive head dropped to her level. The flame in its eyes flared. It spun and disappeared into the darkness. Father Donahue knocked the dottle out of his pipe. He opened a bottle of Templeton rye, another product of his adopted state's fertility. Pouring two fingers worth into a glass, he warmed the 80-proof liquor between his palms before sipping. The second confession confirmed the first. The shaken sheriff's deputy, Sean Morgan, had traced the creature's wrath swath of destruction through the cornfield to find the remains of the two convicts. "Father," he whispered from the other side of the confessional booth, "I've not seen the like. The dead men were pounded into the earth. Besides being mixed into pudding, what was left still smoldered. They had been burned. The spook's hoof prints were cut deep into the ground with knife edges, and the horse, black as the blackest night, eyes of fire, it raced over me and leaped lengthwise over my patrol car. The demon must have been 20 hands high. No plow horse could move like that." Father Donahue's eyes returned to the book spread on his lap. He read, "The Pooka, a Celtic fairy known as a magical shapeshifter, able to take many forms, human and animal. It is usually seen as a coal-black horse with burning eyes and fiery breath. A high-spirited demon, it frequently takes solitary humans for wild rides. In its equine manifestation, it enjoys running through cornfields and knocking down fences. The most feared fairy in Ireland, the Pooka can bring both good and bad fortune. While the spirit is thought to be more fun-loving than evil, there are stories of Pookas killing their victims." Father Donahue looked up. The old priest wondered what to do. Perhaps he should send a report up the church hierarchy. Maybe they would not believe a doddering old man. Whatever happened, his peace and that of the community would be disturbed. He stared across the room. He counted to 10. No revelations came. In this case, justice had been served. The kidnapped and almost raped Shannon rescued unharmed. The two convicts had met with an appropriate end. Evil had been eliminated. Moreover, that it had been Halloween, a night reserved for such specters. Father Ignatius closed the book. He would wait. Deep in his heart, there still resided the wild-eyed boy, listening to tales of his grandfather before the peat-fed fire of the old country.
Dennis Malsby, reading a shortened passage from one of the collections of his forthcoming book. I will promise you this, folks. We will have a full interview devoted specifically to that book right at the time it's going to be released. Until that time, find out more about Dennis, his great work, at DennisMalsby.com. That's your website there to get everything you want to know about this wonderful author, poet, and creative, an Iowa creative that makes him good. So it's going to be a great time continuing to catch up with what Dennis has been doing. Some really good stuff. That is a good story, Dennis. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
We will talk to you later. I look forward to it. Do we have an anticipated publish date?
Well, Murphy's Law permitting, it should be sometime in the first quarter of next year.
That's what we'll look for. Look for more of Dennis Malsby here in the Culture Buzz. I've already got some great interviews in the can, some of his poems that I play on a regular basis. So stay tuned when we find out about Dennis Malsby's latest collection. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you, John.